Space Radio for the Seeker.
Here we are back again. My name is Henrik. Thank you for being here today. We're always excited to be able to speak to you and that you listen in as we continue our investigations into the myriad of different topics that we are interested in highlighting, from the subterranean to things above and beyond the sky. Controversial and challenging in order to make you think twice about the opinions you hold. We enter into both known and unknown territory. And we hope that with information and different perspectives, we can urge you to continue to question what you think you know. If you are new to the program, we go out worldwide across the web through redicecreations.com and redicemembers.com. You can catch us 3 times per week, Mondays, Wednesdays, and Fridays. Usually every other week, Radio 314 with Lana is the Wednesday program. You can see radio314.com or just go from the links from our main Red Ice websites. Freighter X is a published author of both speculative fiction and critical research. He is a lecturer of esoteric philosophies, occult sciences, and mystery traditions. He is a member of 9 different esoteric orders, and is considered a prolific analyst and commentator among his Masonic peers. He is currently working on a new book, The Secret War, Inside Freemasonry, that we are going to discuss today. I've been looking forward to this one. Welcome to the Red Eyes Radio program here, Freighter X. Good to have you with us finally. I've known about your work for some time now, so it's good to have you here. Welcome.
Well, I really appreciate that. Henrik, I'm also a huge fan of your show, and I've known about your work for several years. To be honest with you, when I first started my broadcast just 3 years ago, I turned to you as a source of guests many times because you would have the most interesting and pertinent topics and speakers come on to your show that I would immediately try to get them for my show to continue the conversation. And I would many times sit and listen to your show and take notes and questions and then prepare them for the guests when they had them on my show.
Ah, good stuff. Yeah, that's the way to go. All right. Well, we have some really interesting topics ahead of us here today, Freighter, that we want to run through. Is there anything you want to kind of say about yourself in terms of introduction for our audience that might not be aware of you and your work, something that's pertinent to what we're going to talk about here today?
Yeah, well, you know, I mean, I really thought it was necessary to kind of to go into a little bit of my background just to kind of get a base of an idea of where I'm coming from, my perspective. And as has been promoted, I'm sure, and will continue to be for this show, I'm a member of 9 esoteric orders. I'm a Freemason, a Knight Templar, a Rosicrucian, a member of the Ancient Order of Druids, and many other little appendant orders that it turns out there's something like 600 to 800 separate appendant orders that are connected to Freemasonry, meaning that it's a requirement that you already be a Master Mason, a third degree Master Mason, or a Blue Lodge Mason, as they call it, in order to be a member of these side orders. And so that's a big thing, I think, with regards to my research, my perspective, because it's allowed me over the years that I've been involved and before I became a member of these orders, doing extensive research into the understanding of the history, the origin, the intent of the founders of these orders, and trying to get clarity into all these misconceptions and all these conflicting ideas with regards to the fraternal orders, especially in America. But with my personal story, basically, I come from the kind of background that maybe a lot of your listeners might be able to relate to, in the sense that I was always somewhat of a nonconformist. And right away, I'd like to draw people's attention to there's a writer named Colin Wilson who's written many books about the occult. He wrote an encyclopedia of the occult. He most recently wrote a book called Atlantis, The Neanderthal Kingdom, 100,000 Years of Lost Human History. And he also wrote a book, one of his first books years ago when he was a young writer, was called The Outsider. And this book is really an interesting essay, very, very scholarly work that he did talking about the outside-the-box thinking and its effects on our societies as a whole, and the idea of the outsider being somewhat of an inoculant or a germ that enters into the organism of society and kind of brings about change, sometimes not even within their lifetime, but the change that occurs like a domino effect, a change that occurs that takes over the whole system eventually, you know. And for me, I felt as if I was a ready-made outsider in the sense that as a young child, I was precocious, creative. I always questioned authority I was raised by baby boomers and sort of a setup. Sowing the seeds of rebellion is reinforced with that culture, that generation. You know, they really, I think, they really gave us kids the idea that it was a good thing to question authority. You know, and then of course it was reinforced through media too. For me, I really grabbed onto that and ran with that. I was disobedient in class. I was a disruptive kid, and I was labeled a problem. Though I was very intelligent, well-read, and I just didn't like the curriculum. I couldn't fit into the mainstream, you know, generic public schooling system. And so what I did instead was I began to just merely read, sit in the back of the room with a stack of my own books, and just read to myself. And the teachers, at first, they were a little perplexed, but they liked the idea of me being quiet and not being disruptive. And so they basically advanced me, grade after grade, with incompletes and failures for every grade throughout primary schooling. Now, this basically had a dual effect. Number one, it caused me to realize the sham or the fraud of the educational system as I saw it. And then it opened up a gulf of questions in me as to what was going on. And at first I questioned the teachers, you know, and then I discovered the fallibility, their own fallibility, the limits of their knowledge. And their response was to attack me, sometimes publicly, by public humiliation in front of my peers. Other times they just throw me out of the class. I was even on several occasions outright assaulted physically by teachers for challenging them in the classroom. You know, and there's a writer named John Tiller Gatto, I know you're familiar with, I believe he's been on your show, who talks about, you know, he validated this entire experience for me in a book called The Underground History of American Education, where we learned that the three main things in America that were being offered to students in public schooling, there was only three things being taught. Number one, show up on time. Don't be late. Don't be tardy. You know, that's what they call it, being tardy. So show up on time. Number two, obey your keeper. Obey your supervisor, the direct head above you. And number three, do some meaningless rote exercise in the allotted time until the bell rings and then walk away like it never happened. And that was my experience. And when he laid that out for me, I realized, and of course his solution or his explanation was, is that we were producing good little soldiers and industrial workers. And we can get into this more in the second hour about the idea of compulsion schooling and Prussian schooling and all that. But basically, I turned to literature, which is the only solution, you know, I think for anyone is to read your way out of this prison, you know, at least that's been my experience.
Right, but right.
Basically, books validated my experience. So I dropped out of school and moved into the libraries and reading rooms of America, one of the last in the generation of what we call road kids around here in the 80s and 90s. Freeman Fly, another good friend of this show, was one of those kind of kids coming out in a time when we were drifting almost like disembodied in spirits, you know, drifting around America. I hitchhiked north and south on the East Coast, went from coast to coast, seeking some sort of mystical American experience in some, like, you know, true Dharma bum fashion. I was a real big fan of the beat writers, you know. Mm-hmm. And so obviously I engendered some naive and romantic notions of what I saw, and of the America of Walt Whitman, the America of Jack London and Jack Kerouac. But what I found, Henrik, was a postmodern wasteland with underemployment, pollution, and despair, and then little pockets of affluence here and there, and what one might call also a sub-counterculture, right, within our society, what Kerouac referred to in many of his works as a fellaheen culture, society's forgotten rejects, reprobates, and recidivists, you know, living off of the scraps of the outskirts, so to speak. Mm. And it was quite disillusioning, You know, I drifted far from the warm campfires of this little New England town in Northeast America where I was raised, with white picket fences and white church steeples, and everything was all, you know, exactly as you'd imagine in the Ozzie and Harriet, Leave it to Beaver type reality, you know. But it was just a museum piece, sort of like recognizing an ideal that wasn't real, you know. And so I drifted away from that warm false campfire into the outer regions, the streets of America, and especially into the great national forests of the Pacific Northwest, and then eventually the deserts of the Southwest, and met Havasupai Navajo tribes, and had, you know, many experiences out there. As a matter of fact, after a particularly visionary Amanito mushroom experience of my own, I decided to go back to quote-unquote Babylon. This is in my early 20s, and finish my schooling, go back and get a secondary schooling education. I entered university, studied philosophy and comparative religious study because I felt like I had that aptitude. And, you know, this is all around the time of the Unabomber and the OJ trials, just to give anybody a timeline perspective. But eventually I realized the sham of college education in America with its predatory lending practices, and withdrew, opting instead to continue independent study for free. And it was after this time, after years of doing this, that I met my best friend in the whole world, my loving and supporting wife, who has taken the moniker of Mater X to keep the continuity of this assumed identity that I created with Freighter X, Mater X being Mother X, and Freighter X being Brother X, in the sense that the brother, I was trying to connect with the brotherhood of humanity, you know, the idea that without a cult of personality, without an identity, just speaking as a member of our species, you know. And I also like the idea of playing on the whole Malcolm X and the subculture kind of, like, you know, rebellious sort of activist nature to that. And so it worked. Well, anyways, my wife, she took the Mater X because she is the mother of our family. She's the mother of our children. And so that worked as well. But I want to say here and now that I couldn't have done any of the work I did without her. And for the record, many thanks go out to Mater X for all that I have learned and accomplished. And so while raising our four amazing children, I continued to study and research all these topics, which we talk about now and think about now, starting back in the 90s, right up to and past 9/11 and into the present. And these subjects, you know, Henrik, we all know well, have become the core curriculum of what's so-called truther movement today. And what I mean is subjects like government conspiracies and cover-ups, dark occulted mysticism, the idea of the suppression of free energy, you know, high finance, and the things that Joseph Farrell talks about with alchemy of monetary systems, and just the complete takeover of the species of humanity by captivating its consciousness and awareness. You know, these are big topics nowadays. But when I first started researching them, a lot of people were looking at me funny, like there's something wrong with me. You know, and right. It's really been amazing how we've come back around with this. So basically, this fervor to research and understand things, I turned to my own family history and traced it back through Scotland to 9th century Ireland, and then found out that my own family had become lords of an area of Scotland in 1245 called Luss, and remained lords of that area for over 400 years, and then lost a decisive battle during the English Civil War when my ancestor, we'll call him Ancestor X, he was shackled and sold into white slavery in America in 1650. And he had to work for 13 years in the bog iron mines at Quincy, Mass. Before gaining his freedom. Now, this ancestor I discovered came from a long line of knights and initiates of esoteric and chivalric orders. One individual in this line was known as the last necromancer in Scotland. He died in exile in Sicily in the 16th century. And, you know, no one in my own family knew anything about any of this. So I was blown away right away. And I just kept researching more and more and trying to find out more and more about my own family history. And in 1995, my stepfather, the man who raised me, joined the local Masonic Lodge because he came from a long line of Pennsylvania Masons. And, you know, around the same time, I viewed the JFK movie by Oliver Stone. And it sort of was like a synchronizing event. It began my quest to understand this fraternal esoteric orders in America, combined with a deep need in myself to reconnect to some sort of Western mystery tradition in my own psyche, which I recognized was an important thing that was absent therein. You know, and in the wake of all this research, I realized that the European tribes had been stripped of their culture, just like the tribes in America, right?
Exactly.
Simply 1,000 years earlier by same kind of ecclesiastical authority. And so it was like, wait a second, maybe there's something to this existential angst that I feel, you know, and I saw the mystery traditions as systems containing the remains of a Western spirituality before the corruption of what could be called, like John Lash has coined it, the Abrahamic religious infestations, you know, reaching the limits to understanding found outside the doors of the temple. I decided I needed to continue to understand by journeying into the lodge, by venturing forth into the lion's den, if you will, and possibly recapturing the lost mysteries of my own people. You know, and when I talk about Western tradition, just for a moment, just to kind of give clarity to listeners, Western thought and English, Eastern thought, in my mind, kind of could be thought of as two operating systems on a computer. You got Mac, the Macintosh system, and then you have Windows, you know? Mm. I mean, they both work, they both run applications, they both go online, they both do all kinds of stuff, but they're distinctly different operating systems with distinctly different approaches to the reality of cyberspace and, you know, programming per se. And that's kind of the way I look at the idea of Western and Eastern approaches to reality and spirituality and these esoteric systems. So basically, I found that my understanding is this, that the mysteries are humanity's spiritual, mystical legacy. And that to me is a big thing. It's been taken from us, you know, because it was an empowering system that was in the way of the control system that was busily usurping our species. And we can get into a little bit of that in the next hour when we talk about the secret war on human consciousness. But we're focusing really on the secret war inside Freemasonry, which is the book I'm working on right now.
Right.
And,
yep.
You know, and so basically having been the benefit of being raised by an extraordinary woman, my mother, who's a creative artist and a spiritual person who really gave me that kind of approach to reality and imprinted me with that at a very young age. My mother first dabbled in real ceremonial magic in the 80s, joining women's studies and new age energy groups, which led to becoming a practitioner of a modified form of Wicca in her own right. And as a matter of fact, it was my own mother who presented the system of Western ceremonial magic to me as a viable tool for reintegration, for self-help and self-actualization. Mm-hmm. So this is something that was how it was. So if your mother presents something to you, you're going to kind of give it, maybe if you're on a good terms with her, you're going to give her a little bit more credence than you would, say, somebody outside. You know, you're going to put a little bit more trust in a thing if a trusted family member is the one presenting it to you.
Right,
which is what she was. And so my path was set, doing extensive research into all things occult and esoteric. And I was armed with this as I went into the lodge system. Many Freemasons within the lodge system, having not acquired nearly a fraction of this knowledge in you know, decades of membership in the lodges, because that was not emphasized. And that's another point we'll have to talk about, is the de-emphasis of true education within the lodge system, even though I've discovered that the Freemasonic lodges were always intended to be merely educational systems for the individual Mason.
Mm-hmm.
So this was a direct contrast to what I was sensing. And therefore, you know, that's something that automatically gave me pause.
Well,
and
I just want to ask you this, because you did mention, you know, conflicting ideas within Freemasonry. And that's my perception from being outside of all of this. You know, I've never been close to Masonic Lodge. I've never been a Mason. I have no intention to become one either. I just, you know, what I am as a human being, I like to study it from the outside. And at the same time, I understand, okay, you might not find out everything. Although some people say that, even from the outside these days, you can find most of the tradition that exists within the lodge, you know, in literature and et cetera. But I wanted to ask if you know, with these conflicting ideas, because with most Masons you talk about, there seems to be very, very different ideas of what it is or what there is to find there. And one thing I guess we should preface as well, there's over, I think 6 or 7, you know, million Masons across the world. So basically that's like a small country, you know? So there's a lot of different people involved in it. There's a lot of different intentions of what it should be, and so many different lodges and orders within that and everything. But basically, to simplify the question, I guess, did you find any of the Western esoteric tradition as a continuation within the lodge, Frater?
I found that the evidence is there, that the remnants exist within the lodge. Unfortunately, I believe it is almost like an undiscovered country within the lodge. It's not something, I mean, it's beginning to be the scales are beginning to turn in more towards the esoterically minded individuals embracing the material that's there. But as a whole, as a system, as a tradition, especially nowadays in 21st century American lodge systems, it's been my experience that these things that I found important contained within the lodge are completely downplayed. They're downplayed to the point of almost being denied by the mainstream lodge, you know, powers that be within the lodge structure.
Huh.
But let me also add a little addendum to that. The fact of the matter, one of the biggest things that I discovered after all of my research, Henrik, was that everything I thought I knew needed to find within the lodge system is all over the place. It's available to anyone who seeks it outside of the lodge system as well.
Yeah.
It's not the only place you can find it. And I think I had to kind of go through that in order to discover that for myself.
Exactly.
That's not something I think everybody has to do. And I am not here to recruit people or to convince them to join Freemasonry because I feel that most people, if they're interested in the subjects I'm talking about, would probably be frustrated by their experience within Freemasonry, as I felt that I was, you know, and moving towards that a little bit more, you know, as I rose with some ease within the system of Freemasonry because of the knowledge I brought with me.
Right.
Not because of anything I did within the order. Just because I was able to express myself and convince people that I understood things, I was tapped to join some very prestigious side orders on the merit of my knowledge alone. And I, at the time, it was flattering. But what I didn't realize is that in many ways, I think individuals like myself are targeted and marginalized, not overtly in an oppressive way, but sort of subvertly in a misdirection way. By bringing me into certain research lodges, it sort of diverted my energies and attention away from maybe focusing on what I soon became very aware of, which was a cold or secret war being waged within the lodge system. Because I was being tapped and groomed to be an agent of propaganda for one group over the other. What I mean by that is that there are vying groups and suborders within Freemason who are trying to control the lodge structure by overtaking the leadership and then by changing policy within the subordinate lodges. And it's all part of a vast enterprise that I believe connects to an overarching theme that is basically being perpetrated against our entire species, which alludes to the idea of a secret war on human consciousness. But the idea of the project for the secret war inside Freemasonry was I could use this example of what was going on within Freemasonry as a microscopic view of a macrocosmic effect.
Right.
And so what I found was, you know, having access to libraries and collections of material which shed greater light on the origins and true reality of esoteric fraternal orders, particularly Freemasonry, and especially in America, the history of these orders and the intent of the founders, I became aware that there was something terribly wrong with the stated explicit intent and the resultant effect and realities found within the lodges. And I started to realize that there was a war being waged between two camps, two factions, the lodge members of the Scottish Rite versus the lodge members of the York Rite.
Yeah.
And from this obvious conflict, I began to pay attention to various other orders that were attached to Blue Lodge Freemasonry, because I had no idea, as most people don't, that over, you know, something in the neighborhood of 600 to 800, and I can only give you that because there's no real, a lot of these orders you don't even know they exist until they tap you to join them. So see, that's how secret they are. We're talking beyond skull and bones here on secrecy. You know, this is like, we know the skull and bones exist, but there are hundreds of orders out there, Henrik. We don't even know their names. We don't even know they exist.
That's right. We don't
know anything about them because you don't get to know unless you're tapped to join. And so this is where you get into taking some serious pause with things. And what I discovered became the research that has led to the book I'm currently working on, The Secret War Inside Freemasonry. Now, what is Freemasonry? That's the big question. What is Freemasonry? Well, my answer to that question is I would say Freemasonry started out as a Protestant mystical self-help system of the Renaissance.
When? Where do you date it to?
I would say that Freemasonry, as we understand it, what we could call English craft masonry, probably began, well, I would say probably the 13th or 14th century in the British Isles. I think it did occur in the wake of the Crusades, you know, but I think that it wasn't, there isn't a tidy lineal connection between like the Templar orders and the lodge system of England. And we can talk a little bit about that, you know, as we move through this. But I do believe that this system rose up, you know, probably, well, a lot of historical things lend it to the facts, you know, basically the Reformation of the church in England, you know,
yeah.
That was a huge thing. The throwing out of the ecclesiastical authority and the saying from now on that man has the Bible and God is accessible, you know, and I think that in the wake of all this accessibility, there was a sort of a gap of application. Like, how do we do this? How do we approach our deity? How do we, you know, and from the sense of the Renaissance man, there was a need to formulate a system in order to reconnect to deity without the intercession of the church, the clergy, or the ecclesiastical authority. And I think that in that, several groups found a home in the English crafts masonry system. And you know, I'd like to take a couple moments here and sort of address a former show you had a couple months ago. You had a show where you talked to a man named Robert Sullivan about the Royal Arch of Enoch.
Yeah.
And that was one of the reasons why I wanted to come on your show is to, you know, I don't want to necessarily contradict Mr. Sullivan completely, but there are some key points that he raised that I think need to be addressed. And, you know, first of all, I want to mention that my article and my books are extensively notated, and there's source material. It's not like I'm just coming up with this on my own. I'm going back and reading source material and citing the material and talking about the proofs and the lack of proofs in the claims that go into these different orders. And I would have liked to have asked Mr. Sullivan, because he never seemed to cite it in his talk with you, what a lot of the sources were for his material. I mean, he did mention the Book of Enoch, for example, but there are many translations, you know, and a lot of the caveats he made with regards to the York Rite and the Scottish Rite and the origins of Freemasonry, I think I would take some exception to two, because we can find, you know, you said it yourself, there are so many different versions. There's something in the neighborhood of over 70,000 books written about Freemasonry.
Yeah.
I mean, so that's a lot of material, and a lot of different views can be gathered from that.
That's right.
But one of the things, there's some key misinformation things that need to be addressed here. And one of them, for example, is something that this is the hugest secret in Freemasonry that nobody seems to get or understand. And here it is. I'm going to lay it out here on Red Ice Radio right now. The Scottish Rite, everyone, is not Freemasonry. It is not a part of the actual organizational system of ancient craft masonry in America, English craft masonry in the British Isles, or what would be called Blue Lodge Freemasonry. The Scottish Rite is actually a separate organization completely, with a separate leadership, a separate system, hierarchy, organizational. Everything is all completely separate. The only connection it has to Freemasonry is it requires its members to be Freemasons before they can become members of the Scottish Rite.
Is the Scottish Rite an accepted order by the United Grand Lodge in England?
It is now, I believe, an accepted order only as the ancient and accepted rite. That's the version of it that's accepted in England, which is not what the Scottish Rite is in America.
Hmm.
That is an animal of an entirely different species. And we're going to get into that, right, you know, as in these preceding moments as we talk about this. Another big misconception, Henrik, the Scottish Rite is not Scottish. It is not Scottish. Let me repeat that.
Yeah.
That's not, it's a complete falsehood. If anything, you would be considered French, because that's really the source of its heritage, comes from France. And that's another thing that plays a huge part in how this all unfolds. The origins of Freemasonry in America are very important, because at the time America was colonized, several lodge systems from Europe, now you got to think about it, the official timeline we have is 1717 for the rise of Freemasonry, you know, in the world.
In York, right?
Yeah, it begins at the Apple Tree Tavern.
And what I would just find interesting about that, because I recently did some, you know, research of why it might have been that it sprung up in York, and it turns out that we have an old settlement of Vikings in the area of a time when it was also called Jurvik, which is like York, you know, it's derivative of York, and Vik means like basically sound or something like that. And I always wondered if there was something to the, and this is something that actually Christopher Knight talked about on our program. We have now also another Freemason and out of the UK. And he mentioned about the architectural connections to, you know, older Scandinavian stonemasons, basically those who did works and all that. I've yet to see if there's any connection there, but I just find it interesting that all of a sudden it just kind of springs up out of York after there is certain you know, kind of reformations, if you will, going on of the whole city and the area. And there might be something there, but I don't want to take you off track, Frutter, so go ahead.
Well, also, just wanted to say, great show with Christopher Knight. Really, really, really was wrapped in my seat listening to that show. He's got amazing research. I mean, he brought some clarity to things for me that, you know, just I was really impressed by that show. So it's a great show to check out in the archives.
Sure,
The thing I was going to say was the real telling point about the history and timeline is that if you look at the material with regards to the meeting at the Apple Tree Tavern, 1717, where the Grand Lodge of England was supposedly established, it says right in the historical account that they literally sent out a notice saying that they were resuming communication. That's what they say. Hmm. We are resuming communication at the Apple Tree. That presupposes, right, that there was communication before 1717.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And then, you know, we're always told that four lodges met there, and they established the Grand Lodge of England with four lodges. What we're not told is six lodges showed up that day. Six lodges showed up. Two walked out and said, forget this, went back and destroyed the records in their archives.
Hmm.
So that's another thing. Where did these lodges come from before 1717?
Yeah.
And why did those two lodges walk away?
Interesting. Well, I mean, again, as I said, it doesn't just spring up out of nowhere. This is a system both comprised of Western esoteric tradition. It's part of, you know, operative masonry. I think it's involved in it as well as speculative that started to spring up at that time. But yeah, so tell us a bit more about that. And what do you think the origins of this was and how far back they actually go, these traditions and meetings?
Yeah, I believe that it was probably at least a century earlier, if not more. I mean, I can't prove more than a couple centuries before that time, but the work that I've looked at and the other writers who have speculated before us, I think it's really clear, like you're saying, you're talking about, there was the Roman Comice Collegium, which were also like builders, and there was the actual cathedral builders, stonemasons, and there were also alchemical and hermetic orders that were forced underground by the church persecution that were looking for a home. And these lodge systems made a great opportunity for them to contain and preserve their knowledge, you know, impregnated into the lodge system, kind of the bringing together of what they call speculative and operative masons. Well, speculative masons is a pretty wide open term. I mean, what we think of it now and what was once thought of then, I think, are two different things. And what I think is Elias Ashmole was one of the first speculative masons on the books, and that was in the 1600s.
Yeah, yeah.
So that's way before 1717 as well. And you know, so it's important to know these things. It's important to realize that, you know, that there were these groups that were forming and finding a home, and things were evolving and changing as we move along. And a lot of things were thrown out in that talk about the Royal Arch of Enoch. You know, some of the things, like, for example, the Royal Arch degree as it's found within the York Rite today and as it was found as an independent degree going back a couple hundred years to, well, it's at least 1744. This degree is not at all related to or contained within the Scottish Rite in any form except a co-opted label or title that's probably been bastardized, a plagiarized version from, I would suspect, Albert Pike, reworked and meeting his own personal agenda. And we'll talk about that a little bit more. But according to my research, the Royal Arch degree had already been worked in the British Isles by 1744. There's a book called De Signe's Serious Inquiry into the Cause of the Present Decay of Freemasonry in the Kingdom of Ireland, dated 1744. So he was already addressing the present decay of Freemasonry in 1744. That seems a little preemptive, don't you think?
Yeah, and it seems to me as well that if you try to find official sources, you know, if you go to, James Anderson and try to, you know, find the constitution of Freemason and everything like that, and all the official records, it's always about downplaying the previous kind of existing orders and everything. It's like, nope, it's formed right there on the spot. We came up with it. We invented it. And it's about like shattering the previous connections, severing that in a way, which I always find very interesting.
It also establishes a new authority. You see, we're a new authority.
Yeah.
We're establishing a new authority. You just go on what we're telling you. Don't worry about the past. Just focus right here and now. And that's part of the whole control mechanism, I think, that surrounds these subjects. So, you know, to give a little perspective to the timeline, Albert Pike joined the Scottish Rite in the early 1850s. So we're talking about almost 100 years before the Royal Arch was being worked in British Isles. So we know that it pre-existed, you know, the time. And the present incarnation of the Scottish Rite ritual, which, by the way, has been rewritten numerous times by various members within the order over and over again, right up to the present, was originally designed by Albert Pike from a pile of loose leaf papers he received from Albert Mackey, Dr. Albert Mackey, who wrote the famous Lexicon of Freemasonry, and also the archives of the Supreme Council in Charleston, South Carolina. Now, when Mackey gave this material to Pike, Pike wrote in his own journals that it amounted to nothing more than a pile of rubbish. He literally said about the Scottish Rite material, "I inherited an outhouse and left it a temple." Those are the words he used to describe the Scottish Rite. And it was considered for the first century of its existence to be nothing more than a novelty.
Mm-hmm.
Merely a not like an exhibition that you would show after serious degree work done in the lodge as sort of like just a, you know, exposition, like a novelty, just to kind of see something. And contrary to this was the York Rite, which as in America was called the American Rite. Until the late 20th century, it was still being called the American Rite. It contains all of the ancient craft masonry, as they call it, system within the York Rite. So there's a big distinction right there. When you look at the old structures of Freemasonry, there's that big steps, and it's got guys on each step representing the different degrees of Scottish Rite and the York Rite going all the way up to the top of the pyramid.
Mm-hmm.
And at the very top, and now on the top, there's a Knight Templar and there's a 33rd degree Scottish Rite Supreme Council member.
Yep.
And they're standing exactly even. In the original, which I found searching online, the Templar guy was standing higher originally because the Knight Templar degree was contained within the York Rite, which was part of Blue Lodge system. The Scottish Rite was a secondary order making its way, you know, making inroads into that structure. So it actually achieved that goal of eventually becoming as high as the Knight Templar degree as it exists within the Freemasonic structure. But anyways, Albert Pike, just to speak about him for a moment, because I think he's a real key player in all this. He was, in fact, a past Grand High Priest of the highest order of the Royal Arch in Arkansas at the time, called the Grand Chapter, before he even joined the Scottish Rite, which by that time was almost completely defunct. Mackey communicated, quote unquote, communicated the rite, which means he told him some things, gave him the ritual, taught him the handshake, taught him the secret word, and sent him on his way. That's how you're communicated the degrees. And this speaks volumes, by the way, to the progression of the Scottish Rite in America, because we're told that it came to America in something like 1759. But by early 1850s, it was almost completely defunct. What happened in that first century? How come it almost went down? And then how did it go from being almost completely defunct to being the powerful organization today?
Yeah.
Wielding the kind of power it does.
Let me ask you a little bit about the Grand Orient in France then. And I mean, I put a lot of focus on the Nine Sisters Lodge for obvious reasons with the connection to the American Revolution. And you have a couple of people going, you know, back and forth at that stage. You know, allegedly the Nine Sisters also formed around 1776. People know that number or that year. You know, Benjamin Franklin, Marquis de Sales is one of the other people involved in this. How much have you found in terms of the Grand Orient of France? Because we know that there's a long history of war between the English version of Freemasonry and French version as well, going back into history. So is the French people together with the Americans trying to set up a new power base over in the States? Or how do you view this?
Oh, yeah, there's totally a rivalry between the English and French systems. And one of the main reasons is something I think you can connect to the origins of the different traditions within going back. When we look at, okay, Freemasonry, as we're told, starts in England in 1717, and then it exports to France by 1725. It's in France and in the continent of Europe. And it starts to proliferate rapidly across Europe. Now, what happens is that degrees begin to be invented and peddled almost like en masse. I mean, people start, becomes their job, is it seems, creating degrees that are extra numerary degrees within Freemasonry and peddling them to others. Now, what this did was cheapen Freemasonry in the eyes of the Anglo set. The English craft Masons thought, what are they doing over there? You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. They made it so that you didn't have to be a Christian. They made it so that women could be initiated. They made it so the lower classes could be brought in. They changed too much of Freemasonry for the liking of those in the English craft system. So they were cut off. They were told, you're being irregular. Either you shape up or we're not going to recognize you anymore. And that means that no member of lodge in our system can sit in a lodge with any member from your system, or they too will be irregular. So they and one of the main things that was a deciding factor was within the 25 to 50 years after 1725, the French and German Freemasons began to attach the idea of a lineage back to Templar Mason or to Templar chivalry, the orders of chivalry and the Crusades. This was something that was not supposed by the Anglo craft Masons. As we already talked about, English craft masonry came up out of the stonemason guilds, the cathedral builders, the commissine collegium. These were working class folks. Even if they were tradesmen, they were still in the quarries with hammers and dirt. You know what I mean? And like, you had to work hard to be a stonemason, right? Mm. Whereas the knights of the old orders of chivalry were mostly lords and princes and wealthy patrons who became knights. There's a definite class distinction here between those who would claim lineage to the Templars in the continental system and those of the English craft Masons who would claim the lineage to the stonemasons. Now, you might want to say right away, well, what about all the royals that became members of the English craft lodges? Absolutely. Many of the higher aristocracy were brought in. But that was a program, I think, to lend authenticity and give, you know, credence to the order by having these royal patrons be attached to it. It somehow made it impressive, like a PR move almost. I mean, that's really, I think, what was going on there. But also, you know, we have to speculate. There was some sort of ulterior motives too. You know, that's where you can get into speculation about what might be going on behind the scenes.
On whose part is this being, is this unfolding, this, you know, idea of trying to both co-opt it, of course, but also try to keep it, you know, as it was, the tradition? There is already, I guess, polarized and factions here fighting within. Is that correct? And is there any idea of knowing who they were at this point?
Yeah, there was total infighting. I mean, if there's a book out there called The Secret Founding of America by Nicholas Hadjo, where he talks about Jamestown and Plymouth Plantation in America, Jamestown of Virginia and Plymouth Plantation in America, he distinctly recognizes these as two separate camps of Freemasons, the so-called Scottish Masons and the English Masons, the Scottish being the Jacobites and really French Masons, but the English being the ones from, you know, the Grand Lodge of England. So there was a definite vying for control. And in America and all the colonies of the empires, it was even more frenetic, this vying for control, because it was like open territory. See, a lodge system, a Grand Lodge can go into any area that's not already controlled by another Grand Lodge and set up shop. As long as there's no other Grand Lodge already established in that area, you can go in and set up shop. You don't have to get anybody's permission. If there's another lodge in the area, a Grand Lodge, a leadership body, you know, a ruling body, then you'd have to go to them and get dispensation. You'd have to be allowed to operate within their jurisdiction. The colonies in America were wide open territories. There were no Grand Lodges established anywhere. So all the Grand Lodge systems of Europe were just throwing lodges up anywhere they could in America and starting their traditions. And that's what happened up until the Revolution. When the Revolution happened, the colonists in America shut down all the Grand Lodge systems and said, from now on, America is going to have its own Grand Lodge system. So they basically told all those other Grand Lodges, either agree or you're go packing. You know, you're out of here. We'll just go on without you. And so at that time, at the Revolution, American craft masonry, as a distinct hybridization of all those Grand Lodge systems, became its own form of Freemasonry in America. And that's that rise right then, that the end days of the Revolution, the beginning of the 19th century, at the same exact time, the Scottish Rite Supreme Council announced to the world in like 1801 or 1802 that it existed, that it was in fact the mother council of the world, and that it existed. Now, most of the other lodges in the world and in America just kind of laughed at this bold statement from this almost unknown Supreme Council at the time. But later on, within 100 years, we see that this Supreme Council and its members had made inroads into American leadership and government and business. It was clearly an influential system within a system. And the question remains, how and why? What we know about Albert Pike, who was at the head of this at the time right before the Civil War in America, is that he was, you know, in fact, Albert Pike was convicted of treason for being a Confederate brigadier general for commanding troops against the Union. And yet there's a statue, a 10-foot-tall statue in Washington, D.C., to this day, standing there calling him the Merlin of Masonry. What other convicted treason do you have, like a statue, a bronze statue in Washington, D.C.? None. I mean, that's remarkable. And it seems that he came out of nowhere. He was just what happened was there was a man named John Mitchell who was supposed to be the sovereign grand inspector general I think it was 1860. And I think it was the Polk administration who were in the administration in the White House before Lincoln. All of his cabinet, James Polk's cabinet, were 33rd degree Supreme Council Scottish Rite Freemasons in his entire cabinet. And these cabinet members were making moves right up until Lincoln took power in the White House. And then, of course, the Civil War began to basically arm the South and to do things like, for example, they would send weapons to an unfinished fort right on the edge of the South, between the North and the South, and then they'd leave. And then the Southern troops would just come in and take the weapons on the unfinished fort, and they'd be basically supplying the Southern troops with weapons right before the battles. And this was within the administration of the White House. And so there were key agents, I think, already in the government, already in positions of power within the business world of America, the rising military-industrial complex of the time, that wanted a specific operative in place. And it wasn't this guy, John Mitchell. John Mitchell died right before he was appointed. He died mysteriously. They say, you know, some say it might be poison. We don't know for sure. I don't think anybody did any forensic evidence checks at the time. But basically, when he died, Caleb Cushing, a 33rd degree wolf in sheep's clothing agent for the Confederacy in the federal government, nominated Albert Pike instead. And that move right there changed, I think, the face of Masonry more than anything. Because when he assumed power, they began to step up the program of basically getting as many people as they could involved in this Scottish Rite order, as opposed to going down the road of ancient craft masonry's original educational system that I alluded to at the beginning of this conversation. And you know, it's like this. If you're an individual who's decided to endeavor to improve yourself, and you're basically presented with a system to improve yourself, that's going to require a lot of effort, Henrik. You're going to have to do a lot of personal inventory. You're going to have to look at your own motives. You're going to have to basically open yourself up to extensive research and understanding and try to literally evolve your own thinking, it may seem, at times. That sounds like a tall order. And in order to achieve the goal, you'd have to go through a lot to get to get that order. Or I could give you a patent that says you're a 32nd degree Scottish Rite sublime prince of the royal secret, and you don't have to do anything for it. You just have to show up and sit through one class.
Yeah.
And when you leave, you'll have this fancy patent with a gold seal and a bunch of archaic symbols and everything, and everybody else will be so intimidated and have no idea what it is, they're just going to assume that you have authority from now on. It's a fraudulent, counterfeited version of authority.
So much, and we see so much of this, though, in so many different parts in politics and in, you know, all aspects, basically, where you have people who basically just, they assume the position of authority, and people, because, you know, they act like they know what they're doing, and then people just bow down to that. That's unfortunately how it works. And this is also how, you know, I was thinking about this, how revolutions are made. I think we've been able to see this in the Middle East and North Africa right now as well, in the way that you arm your enemy, you arm the rebels, you know, to instigate a fight, to start a war. Because I've always been amazed in looking at the American Civil War of how many Americans just, you know, were going at each other and killing each other in such a short period that it sprung up in, you know, considerably, and that it just, that it was unfolded in this way. And it's, you know, the more you look into it, of course, as all the other conflicts out there, there's massive manipulation going on behind the scenes, and it's not a surprise.
Yeah, and you know, you this is part of the reason why I point out the overarching theme of a secret war on human consciousness, because I believe this is a modus operandi of basically counterfeiting real true reality, true knowledge for a fraudulent false knowledge, you know, and offering that as real learning and understanding. And this is where we get derailed, I think, as a species, as, you know, in thinking about, you know, thinking about everything with regards to, moving forward in life. So when we think about this in terms of, so we have Albert Pike. He comes into the head of this order, and he's got a lot of sketchy connections, a lot of connections to organizations like the Knights of the Golden Circle. There's a book called In the Shadow of the Sentinel, which talks about the origins of this organization. And then he also is supposedly connected to the KKK. He's also supposedly connected to a couple of orders like the Order of the Palladium, which is thought to be satanic. I mean, there's all these various lateral connections with this man. And at the same time, he presents a work called Morals and Dogma, which if you lay it down next to another work by a man named Eliaphas Levi, who, by the way, was another Jesuit-trained Catholic, his book is Doctrine and Ritual of High Magic. And the two books are so closely related that it's spooky, Henrik. Huh. The idea that I've come up with here is that Albert Pike literally co-opted or otherwise plagiarized wholesale huge parts of this book in order to create almost like a Masonic grimoire in the form of the Morals and Dogma textbook, which, by the way, is not a mainstream Blue Lodge Freemasonic textbook. This is merely, again, a textbook created by the Scottish Rite within their own order, but which is presented to the rest of the world as something more than that, you know, and that's part of this whole counterfeit claim.
And it seems, sorry to interrupt, but it seems like Morals and Dogma is there to, I mean, when I look at it, it looks like it's there to confuse the hell out of the person reading it, and especially if this is given to a person that's just joining the lodge, in the way that it also reveals that, you know, about the bullshit, you know, messages or secrets given in the various layers of the orders and as you know progress through the degrees rather, can you talk about that in any way that it's laid there to kind of confuse people more and I don't understand why it would reveal so much of this secrets for someone who's like, let's say, they're joining the first degree, you know, the Blue Lodge system, and then they're given this book to read about it, and in there it says that basically it's going to be revealed to you in every degree that there's going to be different secrets, and you're going to find out that the previous one is basically doesn't mean anything. Do you see what I'm getting at?
Absolutely. They blatantly tell you they're going to lie to you and mislead you all the way through, and they're going to keep giving you false truths, tell you they're truths, and then later on they're going to give you a new truth and tell you the other one was false.
Yeah.
I mean, that's discordant reality. How can anyone find any kind of certainty in that kind of environment? I absolutely agree with you, Henrik. I believe the Morals and Dogma textbook is literally designed to divert attention. It's a cul-de-sac, a rabbit hole that's designed to captivate anyone who would give themselves to it. And there is plenty of room to speculate as to more metaphysical aspects of this. There's a whole bunch of research out there with regards to something called autonomous spirit entities being drawn to certain rituals and certain ceremonies and certain behaviors that will attract certain autonomous spirit entities, disembodied and malevolent or otherwise, to whoever engages in the practice and the activities.
Interesting.
And so this is something that I'm working on, and I haven't fully, you know, fleshed out the thesis. It's something that, as a matter of fact, myself, Freeman, and Jamie are kicking around this idea because it's so interesting and amazing. If there's any truth to it or any possible credence, that this would explain a lot, as far as I'm concerned, with regards to the goings on within ritual lodge spaces, and it would also explain a lot with regards to how a thing like this could happen. We know that the modus operandi was to offer these honorary titles and degrees to anyone who would take them at first, until you get enough influential people involved that others will perceive the value of also being involved, and then you start charging, you know, and that's how it slowly made its inroads into America. But backing up a little, the official version of Masonic history says four lodges agreed to resume communication. Now, most people didn't know that there were six lodges, right? But we know that. Now, then we know that that's 1717. 1725, a new form of English craft masonry had made it to the continent. It arrived in France. It was embraced like nowhere else except maybe Germany. And for the next 50 years, solid degree peddlers sprang up across Europe, inventing literally hundreds of extra numerary degree systems, complete with fabricated false claims of lineage. And we heard about Ramsay's famous oration in that talk about the Royal Arch of Enoch, which supposedly occurred in the 1730s, though this is not a provable claim. There's also proof out there that says there was more than one oration and that he never said the words that everybody attributes to him today. But what we do know is he was a Jesuit-trained Catholic. Ramsay was too. That's another important detail. And he, so out of this climate, was born a system of degrees, which we will come to call the Rite of Perfection. It was also called the Rite of Strict Observance in Germany. But this claim that was made then about the Templar lineage is what was capitalized upon. It allowed for the claims to be, you know, proliferated and ad nauseum, with the idea that we have this lineage that goes back to this, you know, chivalrous time of honor and all this, you know, the knights of crusades and the swords and the shiny armor and everything, you know. So all that together is fabrication, really. Clearly a fabrication.
So it's interesting. It's, you know, on one end, as I mentioned, with today's, you know, at least in the York Rite, I think, would, you know, when you see certain representatives of the United Grand Lodge, they try to kind of downplay, the significance of the long history and even the connections to the Knights Templars. You know, as late interviews I've seen with them, they always say, you know, there's no evidence for this. You know, we know that it springs up in 1717, blah, blah, blah. But then if you look at the other side, the flip side to this, there's a whole another kind of, where they're trying to create a whole mythology and background, kind of, you know, how ancient it is, and it the creation almost of a kind of like a new religion. You know, it goes back to ancient times, and we don't know how far, but you know, we can connect this and this and this to it. So you have two different elements going on at the same time, and it seems like then the short version, the one who's invented, the Scottish Rite fairly late in the process, is trying to mythologize itself, while the other side to this is trying to downplay it. Very interesting.
Absolutely. That's what my take on it as well. And you know, there's a couple of really important distinctions with regards to, say, the York Rite and the Scottish Rite. And American craft masonry system of Freemasonry in America, the method for instruction and education of a candidate or an entrant into the degree, he's advanced in an active procedure where the candidate is conducted through the lodge space personally, having the degrees communicated in the form of instruction to him personally, individually, in ceremonies consisting of lecture, floor work, which is movement throughout the lodge in a synchronized fashion, charges and obligations, in an unbroken chain of observance centered on a classical education in the form of the seven liberal arts, which are commonly referred to today as the trivium and the quadrivium, along with symbolic and allegorical instruction. Yeah. That's what happens in the York Rite. In the continental degree system, which was inherited by the Scottish Rite, regarded degrees and patents or titles as things that could be simply passed along by patent, like a deed conveying a title or real property, with nothing, you don't do anything to earn this, and that such rights and titles could simply be passed on to others by one holding such patent, and then could be freely given out to that they might too pass them on, and whereby the process might and did continue indefinitely until you had thousands of degree holders who were created who had never even gone through any of the rituals, never even seen the inside of a real lodge building. And however full or scant the instruction and explanation of degrees was a matter of judgment and preference of the original patent holder alone. So there was no consistency, there was no uniformity or continuity to anything. You know, and a patent letter, like a government document or a license issued nowadays, proves its validity in itself. It could not be disputed, especially in the eyes of some, you know, humble master mason of any given lodge of the colonies, an ornate, prestigious-looking document with a giant gold seal and archaic symbols and language is really quite impressive. And you're not going to challenge that unless you've got some footing. And so this new authority was established, which started to ride sidecar along with the traditions of ancient craft masonry in America and the world. And from this is where the great confusions and misunderstandings have arisen. You know, one such patent is what brought the Rite of Perfection, or the ineffable degree system, to the New World back in the 1750s. And if we, you know, we look at the way that this works is there is no real educational system behind the Scottish Rite approach, whereas with the York Rite, the emphasis is solely on education of the individual. And now that's in the best of circumstances, because you and I both know the lodges today, they're not running at full steam. I mean, that's not the best of circumstances. What I believe has happened is even the York Rite has been corrupted by an infiltration in its leadership from those with other agendas.
Just look at Inside the Brotherhood, a book written by Martin Short that shows, you know, the whole debacle that unfolded with the, you know, Scotland Yard and the police and the connections to the lodges there. And some of the things he bring up in the book is kind of, you know, little low level stuff, what it reveals is that there's people that have a different invested interest that have, you know, gotten into the lodge to take advantage of the you know, network that exists there, using it for you know personal gain or what have you. So I mean that's more or less established at this point, but the question is how far up does that conspiracy go? And I think it goes all the way up there, Freder.
Oh, absolutely, but I think that along the way they jump from order to order, you know, skipping across the pond, as it were, until they end up on a lily pad that nobody else can get to. You know what I mean? And they sit there and they're, you know, that's where they call the shots.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
I mean, according to Henry Coyle, who wrote a book called Freemasonry Through Six Centuries, and he wrote that book in 1965. So that's telling about a timeline. Freemasonry Through Six Centuries was the name of that two-volume set, which I have. And in that book, he talks about that from the time of the Revolution until the days leading up to the Civil War in America, the Scottish Rite made just such inroads within the Freemasonic leadership in America. And he also confirms all the things that we've already discussed with relation to the origins and the development of the Rite in France. You know, he describes a scene in the 18th century where the enterprise of degree making had ended in the British Isles in the 1740s. For almost 100 years, they would accept no other degrees except the 3 degrees of the Blue Lodge, and then 2 other degrees they would accept, the Royal Arch degree and the Knight Templar degree, as independent degrees. This is before the York Rite was established. And so that's all they would recognize. So the degree making enterprise moved instead to the continent, and degree peddling became a practice of continental Freemasons. Boastful degree inventors proliferated into a veritable multitude across the countryside, Henrik, claiming their degrees were higher than the craft degrees. Inventors attached absurd lineages, imposing mythic histories and nonsensically transparent historical anachronisms and pseudo-Templar fantastical claims of authority, all that, all bogus. In France alone, the making of Masonic high grades was a thriving business for 50 years, where literally hundreds of degrees were invented and hawked. And this form, you know, it was everywhere except the United Kingdom, where a strict observance of Anglo-craft masonry was in place. And that form of masonry was exported by the British military to all of their colonies. That's how they spread masonry throughout the world. Now, these are two different traditions that are making, you know, trying to map out their own territory, their own turf. And it was in this arena that the Rite of Perfection formed. And it's probable the Rite of Perfection came about in 1754 in France by a man named Bonneville, Chevalier Bonneville. Knight means knight in French, right? This man is said to have constituted a chapter of Clermont in 1754, which was called the Rite of Perfection. It was also called the Rite of Herodom, which is a mythical, mystical mount supposedly in Scotland, like Brigadoon or Shangri-La. It doesn't exist. You know, it's just this mythical Masonic mount that they always refer to in the Scottish Rite. But there were 25 degrees. And, you know, according to the historian Robert Gould in his 6-volume massive history of Freemasonry from the 19th century, all 25 of those degrees have been floating around France detached from each other for many years prior. And then in 1759, another council, a competing council, rises up in Paris called the Council of the Emperors of the East and West. And they also had 25 degrees, but they weren't this other chapter of Clermont. They were a competing council. And there was a lot of those that rose up in France, especially before, during, and after their own revolution. And so this power, the Council of Emperors of the East and West, are the ones who gave one Stephen Morin a patent to establish one lodge of perfection in America, in San Domingo in Jamaica. And so he ended up basically totally going even above and beyond the Call of Duty on that. And eventually Morin was stripped of his authority within a decade for questionable social behavior in San Domingo. Not sure what he did there, but he was taken out. He was defrocked, so to speak, you know. So anyways, just to kind of wrap it all up here in this first hour. You know, what I would say is that there have been many supreme councils that have risen and taken power in the Scottish Rite and French systems over the last couple centuries, and that during these times we saw reversals and switch ups and changes in the structure and the intent to the point where it almost became unrecognizable from the prior orders. And of course, like you said, they would dismiss the former as unnecessary or, you know, obsolete or whatever. Only our version is the good version now, you know.
Yeah.
But basically, the bottom line here is, for me, ancient craft masonry is a progressive system of symbolic and esoteric education. And, you know, one point that your guest, Sullivan, Robert Sullivan, made with regards to the high degrees of continental system plausibly being part of, you know, some sort of Illuminati plot. I mean, that's totally plausible with regards to this from the perspective of this timeline as we've laid it out. I mean, Ramsey was a Jesuit-trained Catholic. Adam Weishaupt was a Jesuit-trained Catholic.
Yep.
Levi was a Jesuit-trained Catholic. The significance of the Illuminati connection is evidence. You know, it proves itself almost just in those right there. But then you also look at the recurrent system, the playbook that's used over and over again. You know, we move forward, we see the same action being taken, the same infiltration, co-opting, usurping, counterfeiting, and then the basically what I would call captivating of the membership. And, you know, one more word about the man you spoke with, Solomon, when he talked about Enoch and his books. You know, the Enochian material is highly interpretive by my understanding, depending on many factors, not the least of which is the translation that you're working with. And, you know, your guest implied at some points that, like, he said at one point that Enoch was trying to fool God. You know, like that was his interpretation, that Enoch was trying to fool God by building the pillars. And it's like, you know, that's sort of a subjective interpretation from my understanding. My reading of the material is that God, according to the books, was instructing Enoch through his angels and all the mysteries of the seven heavens, you know, and holding Enoch in the greatest esteem. So it clearly would be sort of like contradictory to be thinking that Enoch was trying to fool God. But the book clearly cites the corruption of humanity by the Nephilim as the reason for the flood. And that's something that should be emphasized, that the corruption of humanity by the Nephilim was the reason for the flood. You know, that's like a really important fact that I think was kind of, you know, not focused enough on, you know. And another thing that was mentioned was James Bruce, the Scottish Freemason who brought the Book of Enoch back from Ethiopia. He was a member of the Royal Order of Scotland, and he basically stole the original copy of the Book of Enoch, as well as the Kebra Nagast, which is the Rastafarian Bible, from the Ethiopians in the 18th century, I believe, and brought that back to Europe to be, you know, housed in the British Museum or whatever. But the importance of Enoch, I think, you know, let's not forget that Jesus is quoted in the Gospels mentioning Enoch dozens of times. So there's obviously some reason for that, right? But the emphasis of lost and restored knowledge within humanity as a people, within the allegorical teachings of symbolic, you know, esoteric educational system that our consciousness is open to. We love to take in subliminal messages. Our brains want to look at things symbolically. We're wired that way.
Yep.
So we receive information very efficiently if it's transmitted to us symbolically. And you know, that's something that I think that is the root of these esoteric systems, was that they knew that. That this, the people who designed these systems understood that about humanity. And so, I mean, basically in the end, that my book deals with all the particulars with regards to the struggle between the two rites and how I believe it as it unfolded to this day as an actual full-scale secret war within inside the Freemasonic Lodge.
Well, very good. We have so much more to talk about. I have so many more questions for you as well, Fredericks. And we're going to have to take a short break here. You know, as we said, but let's just give out some of the details here as well then. Do you know when the book is going to be available? Is it going to be through your website? And give us your website, by the way, also.
Okay, first of all, 3 years of my archive shows on American Freedom Radio Network can be viewed at AmericanFreedomRadio.com. My website is middlechamberfx, the letters FX, middlechamberfx.wordpress.com. So it's middlechamberfx.wordpress.com. And the book will be coming out on from Sync Book Press. Ah. And that will be, and you know, you're friends with Alan and the whole gang there. So you know that they're a great bunch of guys. And Indeed. They were really excited about taking on this project. We've already got a cover designed. We've already got, you know, a crew ready to edit the material that I provide. But I had a lot of transitions this fall, you know, it's late summer, early fall now. So I've had to, make a bunch of moves that sort of have slowed down the progress. So we're thinking now in terms of probably winter is the release. Mm-hmm. We're trying to, be strategic in marketing the book. It's going to be like a magnum opus as far as I'm concerned with all the material that I've gone out there. It's been an unbelievable effort to try to process all this material, but, yeah, I'm thinking winter 2013 is what we're thinking of in terms of a release on this book.
All right, very good. Middlechamberfx.wordpress.com. We're going to have that website linked up there as well. I know that you guys are working a little bit with, you were working with Freeman as well and Jamie on some projects, and I hope we can have both of or all of you guys back and talk about that as well at some point. But check the website for more details on that, yeah?
Yeah, Henrik, you reminded me. Yeah, everybody, freemantv.com. You obviously had David Icke on recently. The People's Voice Network, we are actually, Freeman, Jamie, and myself, we are working on a project. We're going to have a broadcast on the People's Voice Network in November. So, yeah, really, people would definitely want to keep checking back with freemantv.com, too, because there's going to be a lot there as well.
All right, very interesting. Okay, well, stay with us, Fredericks. We'll take a short break. We'll be right back with more very interesting stuff. So, do continue. Stay with us.
I'm not afraid to die.
Okay, there we go, folks. We'll continue our conversation with Frederix on Albert Pike, the myths of the Palladian Rite, and also the possibility that demons or entities possess people during Masonic initiation rituals. We further discuss the situation in France. The National Grand Lodge of France have basically been falling apart in the last few years and been abandoned by regular European Grand Lodges. We'll also discuss S. Brent Morrison's CIA employment. This is the guy who wrote Freemasonry for Dummies, and he has been highly active as a spokesperson for Masonry. So the question is how Freemasonry is being transformed and why. To continue to listen, go to our members' website and sign up for a membership. We have recurring and non-recurring subscriptions going from 3 months up to 2 years, whatever works for you. It's quick and it's easy. But if you have any additional questions, we have a really good FAQ with questions, answers, information, and instructions. You can also, of course, send us an email and ask us. The website with all the information and where you can acquire a subscription is redicemembers.com. And you should stay with us as we continue on the other side. More interesting details is coming up with Frederix. We'll speak to you there. Thank you for listening.